Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. 9 years and 2 months ago, the UN Women's Conference in Beijing closed with what the final press release described as, and I'm quoting here, a comprehensive plan for the international community to promote the status of women to the ultimate benefit of society. So, 9 years and 2 months later, it's worth asking if the plan is working. And with us to talk about that, we have the woman who headed that conference. Her name is Gertrude Mangela. She's also a member of parliament from Tanzania. She's a former ambassador and now the head of a new organization called the Pan-African Parliament. She probably knows more than most people about the inner workings of global organizations and the challenges facing Africa today, and that's also part of our conversation. We'd like to have you join us. What is the real value of all these international agencies like the United Nations and the EU and the African Union? Are they the best places to solve problems, to help people overcome the effects of war and disease and discrimination? Or do the demands of consensus make them less effective? Furthermore, can Africa fix its problems of famine, human rights, and civil war? Or do other countries like the United States have a responsibility to help? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Gertrude Mangela is here. She is, as I mentioned, the first president of the Pan-African Parliament and a member of the Tanzanian Parliament. It's nice to have you here. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you very much.
Now, you come from an island in the middle of a lake, which is still your home. Is that right?
Yes.
Tell us a bit about the place where you were born.
Yes, I'm very fortunate to be born on an island in Lake Victoria. It's a very beautiful place, and I think people who come from that place are among the lucky people who have a good diet of fish, fruits, and we never suffered from malnutrition. That was not a problem for the time when we were growing up. And therefore, I'm sure most of us have very good, well-developed brains.
Now, sometimes I think we forget how young Africa actually is. The country in which you were born was not Tanzania. It was Tanganyika. Is that right?
Yes.
And it was still a colony of Great Britain at the time. You were a teenager when your country got its independence.
Yes, I was in secondary school.
I wonder if you remember back to that time, what the hope and the promise of Africa meant to you and your friends. Was the independence a big deal when you recall it?
Yes, I just want to go back a little bit to share with you the experience I saw in my family. My father was a great activist for independence in our local area, and he did a lot of sacrifice to make sure that people came on board.
Was he seen as a troublemaker by the British at that time?
Or? He was seen as a troublemaker. He was working at the cotton in ginery, and he had to relinquish his job because they could not take him on board as a politician. Huh. And so we survived more or less. He was a carpenter. Therefore, he could continue doing his work at home. But also my mother did work hard on the farm to feed us and to make sure that we had the school fees to go to school. So we tested we had a test of what it means to be activists in the independence struggle. Could have had better income, but that was all sacrificed. But my parents were able to bring the four of us up to a level of university education. My brother is a lawyer. He's now working in the Antigua as one of the experts for the Commonwealth Secretariat. I myself am number two, and then there are two other sisters. So I think that was something which we can say paid for the sacrifice which my parents had to make for independence. And at that time, the struggle for independence was really just summarized in one word: independence, uhuru, freedom. And that is what motivated the people. I think when you have a cause, you don't need to have a lot of words and describe. These days, we see so many documents, long documents, trying to speak only on a few issues.
Now, you have some experience with these long documents. I remember from the Beijing Women's Conference, pages and piles of tables of documents of people who are trying to use the words to describe something that you say is... It's really so simple.
Mm. Mm.
Did you get your own appetite for politics then when you were a very young girl?
Yes, I did. And I used to admire my father very much and to admire the issues he was talking about. He was talking about dignity. And I thought that was very important. He was saying once you are free, you rule yourself, you can manage your own affairs, then you have dignity, human dignity. And it was easier for me to understand it because in our own language, dignity is very, very, very crucial. An individual, and I think this comes from the Bantu philosophy. We are Bantus. We belong to the Bantu groups. The Bantu philosophy of being a human being, and that philosophy says this, the human being is the most crucial thing related to time, space, and place. So there is Omuntu, the person, Ubuntu, the dignity, Hantu, the place, Kintu, the thing. And that is a combination, but must all work towards the dignity of a human being.
I do want to come back a little bit later in the program and talk more about how you see the place of women almost 10 years after that conference in Beijing. But I wanted to congratulate you on your new position as president of the Pan-African Parliament. I know you've had the job for 9 months, but you didn't come here right afterwards. This is my first chance.
Thank you very much for the congratulations. I think this is, I take it on behalf of all the women, particularly the women of Africa and the women of the world. You remember in Beijing, we were talking about creating space for women as a right. So Africa has shown a way to the other continents that what matters is the individual capabilities and not so much the gender.
How do you explain what your hopes are for the Pan-African Parliament? You know that people have been pretty critical about this so far. They're saying it's just another talking shop, or it doesn't have a budget, or it doesn't have lawmaking capacity. But you must have a vision of what this is going to be. What is that?
First of all, I take that the cue for that vision from the protocol itself. It says the parliamentarians of the Pan-African Parliament will be the voice of the people, the African people, the representative of the African people. And once again, going back to my early life for admiring the political vision, I feel this is very, very, very important, and I'm putting in all my energy and efforts to make sure that the Pan-African Parliament really becomes the voice of the African people. It's the first time that we are going to be heard by the world from our own perspective and not from any other person's perspective.
Now, that means that you are taking on some pretty heavy responsibilities. I was looking through the newspaper just over the last couple of days in anticipation of your coming here, and I see all the troubles in Cote d'Ivoire. I see more women in the Darfur region of Sudan who are now being chased out of their refugee camps, again being subjected to sexual violence, the troubles in the camps in Uganda. Where do you begin? How do you start to deal with some of these issues?
I think what I'm thinking of is first listing, having two lists, the negative and the positive. And when you look at the list of the positive in Africa, it gives you the energy to deal with the negative.
Okay, what am I missing? What's the positive?
The positive is the strength of the African people, the love for each other, the cooperation of the African people, the rich resources of the African continent, the historic contribution of the African people to the development of humanity in terms of sciences, arts and other things, which we have forgotten completely. If you look, for example, at the Egypt as part of Africa, that's where civilization began. If you look at the Olduvai Gorge in Tanzania, that's where you can find the oldest person of, you can say, of the human race. If you look at the Zimbabwe Meno Motapa's ruins, those are the things which indicate that Africa was not that backward. So we have a potential within Africa to recreate Africa, and that's what the African Union is geared to do, to recreate the Renaissance, so that Africa is not looked at it with those wars in Darfur, and those become just incidents. It's like having a war in Iraq, having a war in Sarajevo and other places.
But so, people will still turn to the politicians. People will turn to their leaders and say, Ambassador, what can you do to help us, you know, help the women in Sudan? And they will expect you to have an answer, will they
not? We do have answers. In fact, in our last session in September, the African Parliament already had resolved to have a mission to go to Darfur, because we want to see what is going on. And they have already nominated 7 members of the Pan-African Parliament, and the AU is making arrangements that the delegation goes to Darfur so that they can come back with a report which can be tabled to the House.
And what is your hope about the difference that that will make? I mean, at one point, people look at trouble spots and they say the leaders must be punished, the governments of those countries must be punished. But you're taking a different approach, I understand.
Yes, because what I mean is, before we know what is going on, how do I say somebody must be punished? That's why we have a mission going, to know who is to be punished. And with the experience of the African conflicts, it's not only an African issue. If we have to punish, we have to go all along to punish everybody along the line. I'll give you an example. There are some countries which have been at war in Africa for many, many, many years. And sometimes it's not easy to understand. These same countries cannot even afford to give a pencil for the kid to write with. How can they afford a gun? Who gives them the gun? Those are the people to punish.
My guest this hour is Gertrude Mangela. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Ambassador Mangela is the president of the Pan-African Parliament. If you need a way within which to imagine that, think of the European Union and the European Parliament. This is an opportunity that African nations are taking to try and address African nations as Africans. What then is the role of the United States? Is it time for Western nations to stand back and say, let's see what African leaders will do with African problems, or does the West have to stay engaged? In this case, we get into consideration of what's the place of the UN and what's the place of foreign aid. Ambassador Mangela is with us for the balance of the hour. If you have questions or observations about that, we'd love to have you join our program. Once again, the number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. With me in the studio, Gertrude Mangela, first president of the Pan-African Parliament. She's also a member of the Tanzanian Parliament, was ambassador to India for her country in 1991, and is known to people around the world as Mama Beijing for her role as Secretary General of the UN Conference on Women in Beijing in 1995. Once again, our number is 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to take our first call from South Boston, Virginia. And Russell is on the line. Hi, Russell.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. What's your question?
You're welcome. My question is, how do we make any corporation that has extracted any type of wealth or profit from any areas of this part of Africa in the past, make them pay for whatever needs are needed for the people. Make them pay, because I don't believe that the people of America should be helping them. I believe that the corporations that have extracted gold, diamonds, oil, and wood, lumber, and whatever wealth from these countries should pay back.
So you're saying international corporations are the ones that should carry the load for providing assistance to African nations that need that assistance, right?
Absolutely, because they're the ones that have been profiting off of Africa's wealth for the past, I don't know, 150, 200 years, and have given back almost nothing. It's always been put on us, the people. Whenever the aid came, and it was always put on us, the people. I believe that these corporations should be forced to give back.
Ambassador, what would you say to Russell on this? Do the corporations, do these global corporations have a larger responsibility than they're shouldering now?
Yes, I think they do. And in fact, we are starting to think along those lines. Just recently, when we were having a session in South Africa, I did remark to that point. If you look, for example, at the financial position of the African Union and the Pan-African Parliament, it's not very strong. And it's not because we don't have resources. We've not been able to look into alternative sources of funding. And this, I think I'm happy that he has raised that question, because I raised the one question that if you look at the mining sector of Africa, if you look at the transportation sector, if you look at other natural resources in Africa, you'll be able to raise a lot of wealth which could go to the development of the African continent. We are now embarking on the implementation of the NEPAD program, which is the new initiative for development in Africa. And we have big, big programs, the energy programs, transportation, and so on.
But I know that there were going to be, you know, dyed-in-the-wool capitalists in this country who say, now, wait a second, if you start taking profits away from these corporations, whether they're mining corporations or airlines or whatever, they're just not going to bother doing business in Africa.
I doubt it. If they've never stopped it for more than 200 years, why should they stop today? We have something to offer. But the problem is Africa has never been given the value for the products. And I think the man who was asked the question is right. We have to look into that. If it's serious business, we have to level the playground. We cannot continue at a situation where we are more exploited. Gold is gold, whether it comes from Africa or any other part of the world. And we think that gold that comes from Africa has not been properly remunerated. And diamonds and all these other things. I think
oil in Nigeria
and so on. So I think there's so much getting out of Africa which is not paid for. Even the human beings, we did contribute to the... There are black Americans here. They are our people. We share the same DNA.
So true. 1-800-423-8255. Next to Pittsboro, North Carolina. And Wendy's with us. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Good. I'm so happy you're talking about Africa today. My husband and I lived in Senegal for 10 years. And when we moved back to the U.S., we were thinking of things to do. And we were listening to all the bad news about Africa. And we knew all the positive, and we really wanted to share that and have started working with micro-industries around Africa and promoting their products here. And I really think the ambassador was right when we don't in this country understand the values, the positive nature, the potential of African citizens. We see what happens with political leaders and governments and things that go astray. And there's so much potential there, and I think that that's where we need to go.
Okay, but Wendy, help me again with this, because I'm a journalist, and I look at the newspapers, and the newspapers are full of stories about countries that aren't working, about civil wars, about refugee camps, and it's hard for people who don't live in Africa, who don't have that close connection that you do, to see beyond that. People look at Africa as a place where there are more problems than solutions. How do you get people beyond that?
I don't know. I think it's just contact and word of mouth and maybe if we could concentrate a little bit more on the small stories that are wonderful, the way cooperatives can work, the way women work together. I think the other problem is that we tend to compare life in Africa with our life here. And I think that's very dangerous because even though there are areas where there's great poverty, there's also incredible richness mm-hmm. in the value of life and the way people treat each other and care about each other that maybe we have forgotten here. And I actually heard yesterday, I have a son who's in seventh grade. He came home and he complained. He said, oh, my teacher talks terribly about Africa. And mm-hmm. my son was born in Senegal. And I said, what? And he said, well, he said, in Chad, they have no water, and so they can't live like we live here. And I thought, you know, this is it. We look
okay, but
at,
let me, if I can, though, Wendy, turn that to the ambassador, because I don't know that it's really such a bad idea to say or to think or to believe that people in Africa, in any part of Africa, deserve the same quality of life that, that people enjoy in the United States. If the standards are so different right now, why not say, you know?
I think, Wendy, I'm so happy that you have understood Africa. In fact, one of my major questions is, do people really know Africa, those who write about Africa? Are they not just tourists for 2 days and they make conclusions? And I think I learned quite a lot about not making speedy conclusions when I was preparing for the Beijing conference. I used just one of the indicators of representation of women in decision-making bodies. And if you quickly make a conclusion, we'll equate the representation with maybe economic development. And I found out that, in fact, the IPU, the International Parliamentary Union, had brought out a map, and they marked, I took the color pink, where my country, Tanzania, was the color which was indicating Tanzania. And that, those are the countries which are 10% and below. And Canada was in pink. The U.S. was in pink. All those countries you think are great were in pink. And then suddenly I said, what's the reason for all being in pink, including Tanzania, the poor, one of the poorest nations? So you have to look for a reason. The reason, for example, for media to portray that, they think they sell their newspapers. But at the same time, the media has been dominated by the Western media. And therefore, they have given a lot of negative images to Africa to the extent that everybody is digesting the media without questioning. And it's people like Wendy who have been to Africa who are able to discover what the values of life we have. For example, at one time when we were preparing again Beijing, I said in Africa that case of O.J. Simpson where the wife died could not have happened in Africa. When you have so many houses close to each other, somebody would just have come to rescue somebody at the year. But here, nobody seemed to be knowing what had gone on. And this is what happens even in violence against the women and children. You always deal with it with a human touch, that when you yell, people come to your rescue. Here, you have to take a telephone and call. Telephone does not replace the human touch. But I want to say we are different. The level of development is definitely different. But again, I say, while Wendy's looking for the dishwasher, I'm looking for the water to wash the dishes. The task is still the same. The task is still the same. So when we are looking at the development of Africa and the development of the other parts of the world, we have to appreciate, where do we spend our time in Africa while other people are developing? We spend our time facilitating and enabling other countries to develop. And I think it's a matter of right that they now have to spend time facilitating Africa.
You were in an international meeting, I think, just 3 weeks ago in Addis, in Ethiopia, talking about women's development. Were you part of that meeting as well?
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask you about that and ask you to use that as a measure for what's been achieved. I began the program by saying it's been almost 10 years since Beijing. When you think about what women have today as opposed to what you were hoping for in Beijing, are you satisfied with where you are? Are you feeling that things could be a lot further along? I'm not sure. You're being very positive on the program today, but is there a part of the story that still needs a lot of work? Women living in poverty, women who are not getting access to land or credit or health care or education.
I think I'm very positive in the sense that it's now an open agenda. When we went to Beijing, so many of the things were taboos, were not spoken about. One of them was violence against women. Many people in society took it for granted that domestic violence is not an issue. If a woman is battered by a husband, it's okay because it's a domestic affair. But now we have moved out of that. So what I do appreciate is that the problems women have experienced have been problems, they have been there for centuries. And for somebody to think you can solve all these problems in 10 years, that's very unrealistic. That's very, very unrealistic. So what we should be doing is, first of all, accepting the principles. And most of the time, from Beijing to now, we've established a lot of principles. One of them is that women's rights are human rights. That's now a principle. You cannot refute that one in any meaningful way. So the human rights issue has been well established. The fact that violence is a violation of a human right is also a principle we've established. In Africa, we've even gone further. The presidents, let's say, of the SADC region have even made a declaration of the 30% achievement in representation. And I think now, for example, Rwanda has 46% representation in parliament, and the other countries in the sub-region are also following suit. So they have added on the whole continent. We have even the principle of parity, that Africa must exercise the concept of parity when it comes to sharing power. And we have already started with the African Union. 10 commissioners, 5 women, 5 men, and the declaration has been made that this should be applying across the board up to the lowest level in society.
My guest is Gertrude Mangela. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. We're going next to Nashville, Tennessee, and Godwin's on the line. Hi, Godwin.
Good morning.
Thank you for calling. Tell me what's on your mind.
I'm glad your journalism is not biased. Thank you. How are you, sir?
I'm very well. Have you got a question, Godwin?
Yeah, I got 2 questions. My first question, good morning, Her Excellency, the Ambassador.
Good morning, Godwin.
Yes, sir. My first question is somebody like the international companies that have siphoned everywhere from Africa, if they pay the royalty to the African leaders, are they going to be able to use it for the people, or they will siphon the whole money and send it to the Swiss bank? That's my first question.
You know what, Godwin? I'm going to take your first question. It's a good one. It's a clear one. And I think it's an important one because, again, it's the way people have questions about the governments in Africa. I'm going to rephrase it for people who may have missed it. He's saying that if the international corporations were, in fact, to pay money to the African leaders, what guarantee is it that the African leaders are going to take that money and put it in a Swiss bank account?
The parliament is there. So, Godwin, don't worry. For this time, we are going to be holding people accountable for their actions. And that's why we need to strengthen that parliament. We have 10 committees to look into the issues. And you sound like one of the parliamentarians last time who was also talking of the same language, that we should stop people banking money into foreign countries. And maybe we should also hold accountable those countries which take money from thieves and bank them in their own country.
Does the Pan-African Parliament have as part of its responsibility, though, good governance? We know that there are countries that have different standards of government in Africa. It's nowhere near as bad as it used to be, but there's still corruption. There's still corruption at the low level and at the high level. How does the Parliament deal with a member state where you say, you know, things are not operating here as well as they should? What can you do?
In fact, Africa is developing institutions to deal with that. For example, if you look at the monitoring, which we call the African peer review mechanism, it talks about that we have, and member states are enlisting voluntarily. Now we have about 23 countries already signing for the African peer review mechanism, which will deal with the human rights issues, which will be dealing with the human rights, the governance, and
but you still have protesters who show up at the parliament with their signs saying, you need to speak out about Robert Mugabe, you need to speak out about Zimbabwe. Can you do that? Can you be that specific about one member state?
We can be specific, not only African member states, but even member states who destabilize Africa. I think we have to go that far. We cannot just stop at member states within African context. But we also, the Zimbabwe question is such a tricky question because people take it as if it's out of context. The question of Zimbabwe is within a historic context. When Zimbabwe got independent, I mean, they were told not to negotiate the land issue until after 10 years. This is what is never talked to, especially outside Africa. We in Africa know it, that when Zimbabwe was getting independence, they had asked to discuss the redistribution of land because the bulk of land was in the hands of the whites. For example, even today, there are some people who have got land equivalent to the land size of Belgium, one person, while there are some black people who do not have the land. This is never explained. So when they wanted to deal with that question, then they were told, wait until 10 years. After 10 years, they were told again, wait until we finish the independence of South Africa.
I need to stop you now, for just half a second, because we need to take a break here. But it's a great example of what we were saying earlier in the program about just how young the country is, the expectations, the opportunities for the Pan-African Parliament, and whether or not Africans working within those organizations are best able to deal with problems in that continent, or whether or not the United States, people in this country, politicians in this country, also need to stay very much engaged. 1-800-423-8255. That's the number to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. In March of this year, in the middle of March, just 9 months ago, the Pan-African Parliament was formally brought together for the first time. Gertrude Mangala, Tanzanian parliamentarian from Tanzania, was asked to be the first president of the Pan-African Parliament. She's here with me in the studio. We're talking about the continent that the Parliament is now responsible for. We'd like to have you join our conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Our next call comes from Amherst, Massachusetts, and Johannes is with us. Hi, Johannes.
Hello.
Thanks for calling. What are you thinking?
Thank you for taking my call. I basically agree with the ambassador about the role of women in Africa and women being the backbone of any potential positive change that might come. Because women, whatever they get, they spend on the family as opposed to men. They generally, from my experience in Africa, tend to be more responsible. Where I have a problem is with, for example, the case of Zimbabwe. The ambassador just said that it was 10 years later that the issue of land distribution was allowed to be raised when the independence came. Zimbabwe's independence came in 1980. Mugabe did not raise the issue in 1990. Instead, he began to raise it when he began to have political problems 20 years later or so. So my point is, I think we should vigorously expose the dictators that are really ruining Africa. And never apologize for the dictators. And there is a tendency to romanticize Africa. And I think nationalism sometimes, like Pan-Africanism or, you know, Pan-African Parliament and those kinds of things, you know, they sound grand ideas, big ideas. But in reality, you know, it's better to really deal with the details of and the problems that we really have and expose them. Because we should not be embarrassed to admit the kind of dictatorships that we have. in Africa. I mean, this is not just an African trait. Dictatorship did not start in Africa.
Johannes, I'm going to ask you just to hang on the telephone. I don't want you to go away. I want to give the ambassador a chance to talk with you directly.
Yeah, Johannes, I think what I was saying was not being apologetic. I was putting things in the historic perspective. If you look at the Lancaster Agreement, it was clearly stated that the land issues will be dealt with after 10 years. That's a fact. And then after 10 years, when Zimbabwe tried to raise the issue, this is when we were in the middle of the struggle for dismantling apartheid in South Africa. And again, it was thought not to be wise to disturb the whole process of dismantling apartheid. So it was also put on the shelf.
Can I ask you, though, to go to the point that Johannes was making about the danger of not blowing the whistle, calling a dictator a dictator? I think the word that he used was romanticizing Africa.
No, that's, what I want to say is exactly, I'm putting him within a context. Now, in that case, who is a dictator? Those who dictated the terms that the land issue should not be solved immediately after independence, because we've seen in places where we had problems like the King, the Maryland case in a Maryland case in Kenya. It was solved immediately and we didn't have a problem. And that's, land was the first thing to be solved. But those who postponed it within the negotiation of the independence of Zimbabwe have brought a lot of questions. We cannot lose that one. Now, coming back to what is happening today, you can criticize the methodology of going about the land question in Zimbabwe. That one, you cannot apologize if there is a mishandling. But as an African, what I want to say is that in Africa, in our African culture, you don't throw your brother out of the house because he's not managing. You have to put your things together so that you can help people to do the right thing. That's what we are doing.
Yeah, but people would say that Robert Mugabe has had too many opportunities to put his own house right, and that maybe it's time for Mbeki and all the people to stay.
According to whom? According to whom?
I don't pretend to be a wise person. Johannes, help me out here. What?
I also wanted to speak about Pan-Africanism. Pan-Africanism is not a new idea. This was an idea which was thought of very wisely by the African leaders, the founders of Africa. And maybe here we should be able to quote exactly what Kwame Nkrumah said. Kwame Nkrumah was very, very, very specific when it came to Pan-Africanism, because he thought of it as a way of bringing Africa together. And he said, exactly, precisely, he said, if we are to remain free, we are to enjoy the full benefits of Africa's rich resources. We must unite to plan for our total defense and full exploitation of our material and human means in the full interest of our people, the African people. To go it alone will limit our horizons, curtail our expectations, and threaten our liberty. Is that really a wrong concept? That's the right concept.
And Johannes, Johannes, go ahead.
That's why people are talking about globalization.
Let Johannes in for just one more comment from him.
Why people are talking about globalization, breaking the walls.
On the specific issue of Zimbabwe, if I may say something, yes, you know, the land issue has merits. And there's no question that there was a lopsided land distribution situation in Zimbabwe. My point is, Mugabe is not raising it for that reason right now. He's raising it because it's politically convenient for him, so he can stay in power for as long as he can. An 80-year-old man, or even older perhaps, and I am not discriminating because of his age, but, I mean, being president for life, like Kamuzu Banda, Mugabe, and various dictators that...
Johannes, I'm going to interrupt you here. I thank you for your call, but there are a number of people who want to get on, and I'm watching the clock tick down on the program, so I'm going to go straight to Toronto, and Sonny's joining us on the line from Toronto. Hi, Sonny.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm fine. What are you thinking?
Let me concur with the previous caller. I think it's time we have a straight talk. I'm glad that you that Ambassador raises the issues of traffic. But I think we raise the wrong issues.
Sonny, I'm afraid that your telephone line is deteriorating to the point where I can't hear you. So I'm gonna leave you there and jump straight to Boston to TJ, who's joining us from Boston. Hi, TJ. TJ, you're going to have to turn your radio down and talk to me on the telephone. Can you do that? I think we're having a little bit of difficulty with our electronics here, but let's go back to what Sonny was doing. Sonny wanted to jump in with Johannes. I hear both these people, in a way, asking you to be more firm, to say, if there's a problem, there's a problem.
What I want to say, really, who is to solve that problem? Isn't it the people from Zimbabwe? By using their votes? We have seen the elections in the United States. The United States people decided what they wanted to decide, who should be their president, by using the ballot. That's what should be done in Zimbabwe. It's not an individual dictating. If we use the words and then we use them. Dictate means, dictatorship can be a political person in power, but even us who are not in power can dictate. We are trying to dictate upon the people of Zimbabwe. They are the ones to use the power of the vote to choose the people. So if we do not want ourselves to be dictators, we should let the people of Zimbabwe decide who rules them and for how long.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. I do want to ask you where the Pan-African Parliament, where the African Union, where these regional political organizations are going. Because you will know from all your experience with the United Nations that that was an organization set up to prevent war, number one, and to provide a gathering place for people all around the world. A lot of people in this country are very critical of the UN, and other people have questions about it. I don't, rather than going into a long debate about the UN, I'm curious to know if you think that 20 years from now it will be the South Asians dealing with South Asian problems, the European Union dealing with European issues, the Pan-African Parliament dealing with African issues, if the time of the United Nations may be past.
That's not correct.
No?
No. Because the United Nations unites all these efforts. That's what it's supposed to do. Unite, coordinate, get at universally agreed principles, which you cannot reach at just by having individual groupings. Let's take the example of Africa. For example, we have the Pan-African Parliament, but we still have regional parliaments which just focus on the regional specialities. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about Africa, for example, dealing with the conflict in Darfur, we do not mean that we are excluding everybody in the world, but we are saying we are taking the responsibility because it's within our area. So the United Nations have to be revisited to see the new challenges. For example, if you look when the United Nations was formed in 1945, it's a long time. It's a long time, and so many things have happened. So many nations which were never members of the United Nations were born. So we have to look into that. What difference does it make after bringing in such a big number of other nations which were not recognized at that time?
Okay, but let's put it in practical terms here. If the United Nations failed dismally to prevent the genocide in Rwanda. If the Pan-African Parliament had been in force for some time, if the Pan-African Parliament was an acknowledged, recognized organization that oversaw all of the affairs of Africa, would that have been a better way to help the people of Rwanda?
I think, I think we cannot judge each issues by generalization. What we should take is at that particular time there was no Pan-African Parliament.
Right.
So we cannot start theorizing about whether if it were there, it would have taken another thing. And even in the United Nations, it's made up of members. In fact, it's the members more than the organization. We have to be directing these questions to members of the United Nations. Why are they behaving the way they are behaving? These are the critical issues which have to be raised. And that's why I'm saying is the discussion on even expanding the Security Council to accommodate more members, I think is a very, very, very valid question.
Okay, but let's use as the example Sudan, because now we do have the Pan-African Parliament and we have the United Nations. You've sent a mission there. You are sending a mission there. Do you think that the best interests of the people in Sudan will be looked after by Africans in the Pan-African Parliament, more so than the UN, perhaps?
I think we have a responsibility as Africans. We have a responsibility. United Nations has a responsibility because one of its member states is having a problem. So that's, you cannot say either or. It's efforts from different angles. From the point, the African point of view, the way we are dealing with Darfur is, again, we don't want the Rwanda situation. Everybody sat waiting, and we got what we got with the genocide. So this time Africa is saying, no, no way. We have to start doing things, dealing with the Darfur question from the African perspective, and the other people will come to support our efforts.
I want to thank you for spending an hour with us on the program. It was nice to have you here.
Thank you very much.
Gertrude Mangale is first president of the Pan-African Parliament and organizer of the UN Conference on Women in Beijing. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.